Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 24th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum today, and our phone number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If you have any science-related question at all, give us a call or email voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. We talk science today on the program, and it begins after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and we bring a panel of scientists who answer your questions. All right, the panel is one at this point, but I think the panel will grow. The number to call is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number here is 800-348-2551. And the panel of one, well, it's Ed Stander. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you?
How are things going with you?
I'm having just a wonderful time just across from you.
That's great.
The weather here is as nice as it
really?
Is over there.
It's yep. Very nice over here. It's 72 degrees. Barbara Brabets will be here.
Yes, she will. She's stuck in traffic.
Jim Pickett, not here today.
He's stuck in Cape Cod.
Oh, that's nice. And you brought something. I'm a little disappointed today. In addition to being shorthanded on the science department, you brought what we talked about last time.
Right.
And it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
What happened? What is it and what happened?
Well, it's a theremin.
Cool.
It's a theremin. And basically what a theremin is an instrument you don't have to touch.
Okay.
It's the first synthetic instrument, the first synth, if you will. And basically what happens is it has a rod on it.
Right.
And as you get close to the rod, you start grounding the rod.
So it acts like an antenna?
It acts just like an antenna. And there are two oscillators inside. And the two oscillators are exactly matched. And as long as they're exactly matched, that you can't hear them. But if you get close to the rod, then what happens is one of the oscillators starts to change. And as a result, when you have two of them and they're slightly off, you get what's called a beat frequency.
Ah.
And the beat frequency is very often much, 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 much lower than the frequency of the two oscillators. So you start hearing it as a sound.
Interesting.
Yeah. So one of the rods is for the pitch. The other one's for volume.
And but I only see one on there.
Well, there's the second one on the side.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it really sounds great when it works, but it doesn't right now.
And we had a little power issue.
Yes. Well, we'll get it working for next time. That's guaranteed.
Okay. And just, Zach, just so people can hear what it is, just play a little of this. That's a clarinet. No, it's coming. Trust me. Lovely, lovely music. That's great. Thank you, boys. That'll do, Zach. Thank you very much. So yeah. That's this was invented when?
It was invented in the 30s by a fellow named Leon Theremin. Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Russian. And he traveled around Russia. He developed the instrument. He taught his niece to play it, I believe. And she became very famous. Clara Rockamore played it for years. He came to the United States for a while. And then when he went back to Russia, they decided he was too dangerous to be kept around, so they sent him to the Gulag for 30 years.
Because he invented the theremin.
If you actually heard how badly I play, you'd know why he got sent.
Well, now you play very well the glasses.
Right. And if you play the glasses, then you have to play the theremin because it's almost required. So I actually have three theremins, one of which is not working, and it's here.
Thank you for bringing the one that doesn't work.
Well, it's really interesting to look at for those on the radio who are, you know, listening.
Well, if you're watching at WAMC.org and clicking video, you can have a look at the immobile and inaudible theremin.
Well, here's the trick. One of the rods is for pitch. The other rod is for volume. And what the volume one does is it takes the two oscillators and it switches the signal from one of the oscillators.
Mm.
And if what happens, therefore, is that one oscillator effectively, when it's going up, the other one's going down, and they subtract from each other. So you can actually cut out the sound entirely just by getting close to that other rod. So you can imagine the theremin is working really well right now, except I'm too close to the volume control.
I see. But how good can you get on this? I mean, can you be virtuosic on the theremin?
Oh, there are people who've traveled around the world playing it.
Really?
Yeah, and people listen to it once.
Well, our number here is 800-348-2551. That is one that you built, right?
Right.
Very interesting.
And that's why it doesn't work.
No, it's a power issue, and we tried. We did our best.
Right. The original theremin, Leon Theremin made a number of them, and if you find one, you don't have to win the $750 million Powerball. You've got something. RCA made 50 of them, and GE and Schenectady made 50 of them.
Interesting.
Before they stopped producing.
And you have one.
And I have one of the RCA units.
Did they really think it would take off?
Well, not only did they make theremins, but they made theremin cellos, where as your hand goes different positions on the neck of the instrument, it would play different notes. They made theremin, all sorts of instruments. They had a whole theremin orchestra at one time.
Very, very interesting indeed. And you actually played this in public for people.
Oh, I've played it many times in public.
Unfortunately, not for us.
Well,
today.
I will play it next time.
Ed Standers here. It's the Science Forum. He is our panel today, at least until Barbara gets here. Our number is 800-348-2551. If you have any kind of a science question, stump the band. It's always easier when there's only one third of the panel. Did you see the eclipse?
You bet.
Yeah, what'd you think?
It was...
Underwhelming, eh?
It was underwhelming.
Yeah.
I would say that's the word. But, you know, as you say, in 7 years, it's going to be passing right nearby, so we'll get a better shot at it.
Now, I have not seen the path, but I understand that if we go only a little bit north of our studios here in Albany, we will
right.
be able to see
it. I believe it goes right through Syracuse, then heads north from here. And considering that people were supposedly getting $10,000a room... Down in Kentucky.
Really?
Yeah, for people to come down there from various places and stay overnight so they can see it. I think we can do much better because ours is going to be longer. Theirs
How
was
long?
Only 2 minutes and 7 seconds. I believe ours is around 3 minutes.
Oh, long. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
So it's definitely worth another couple of grand. Our number here is 800-348-2551. And Barbara Brabitz is here. While she gets set up, we'll take a call from Fred in South Westerlo. Fred, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on.
All right. Yesterday, about 7:15, somewhere in there, while there were general storms in the area, mm-hmm. I was on the phone with a friend from New Jersey who was on his computer, and he was asking me whether the storm had hit my area. And I said, no, not at all. And right at about that time, there was a tremendously loud crack, more like a rifle report than anything else, followed, I would say within a second or at the most two, by another loud crack. No thunder, and as I said, no sign of rain or even a very cloudy sky. And I'm just wondering, could they have been lightning strikes?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, did you see the flash prior to the sound of the boom?
No.
No flash. And were there
clouds? No, it was really quite light out.
Okay. Because what you could have been seeing is air-to-air lightning or hearing. What happens is that sometimes if you have a differential in electricity in the sky, that the lightning, instead of hitting the ground, will hit another cloud, and it actually shows up inside the cloud. So you may not even see it. That would be my guess is what you probably saw or heard.
It sounded like it very well could have been it.
Well, if it's very loud and very sudden, then it probably was very close as well. And if you didn't see
it was. I thought it was just outside my window.
Yeah, then that very possibly might have been what it is, because those can be very close, and you may not even see anything.
So, I'll repeat again, but there was no thunder at all either of the strikes.
That's because
the crack is the thunder.
That's right. That's what you heard. Because you were
all
so
right.
close that you didn't hear the rumble associated with from a distance.
Fred,
so,
go ahead.
The good thing is NOAA reads down now all the thunder that hits, or all the lightning rather, that hits the ground. So if there was cloud to ground or ground to cloud thunder or lightning, it would have registered as a strike, and you can go and check the almanac within NOAA at your nearest weather station, and it will show you the lightning strikes from yesterday.
How does NOAA check every every lightning strike?
It's a conductivity thing. They have meters, and then they can triangulate where the strike is based on the surge.
And they cover 100% of the ground on the Earth?
Certainly New York, yes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can – I have an app on my phone that tells me where the lightning strikes are relative to my phone position. So I know if I have to duck and cover now or duck and cover in 2 minutes, or it'll say like 2.3 miles northeast of you, lightning strike.
Well, that's a handy app.
It is, except if I'm looking at my phone when the lightning hits me. Then it would only go bleep afterwards.
Right.
Gotcha.
Right.
And you can actually download maps of where the lightning strikes were for a particular period of time
right.
as well.
They log them. See if there was one. It has to be hitting the ground, though. The air-to-air does not register.
You made it, Barbara Bravis.
I did.
Nice to have you here.
It's good to know the economy is so – there's so much construction on the roads. It must mean there's an upswing in the economy.
Rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 800-348-2551. We'll be back on the Science Forum.
Support for WAMC comes from The Gift Garden, Bennington, Vermont. Florist and gift shop featuring fresh flowers, arrangements, green and blossoming plants, home decor, candles, gift baskets on Main Street, thegiftgardenvt.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Huntsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. edith-huntsberger.artistwebsites.com. The New York Military Academy, Cornwall, a co-ed college preparatory boarding school focusing on academics, character, and athletics, now accepting applications for fall 2017. NYMA.org. And Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire. Featuring a Boar's Head Deli with daily specials, bakery, homemade fudge, smoked chicken and rib dinners to go, fresh seasonal native produce, and Black River meats. WhitneysFarm.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Science Forum. Ray Graff here, joined today by Ed Stander and Barbara Bravis. And the number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We go to Pierre in Westerlo. Pierre, you're on.
Hi. My question was about the eclipse, which I heard you say was underwhelming. And I guess you were here when it happened, because I was actually over in Murfreesboro, which is in southern Illinois, right by Carbondale.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
much better.
Totality would be great.
Experience, man.
Yeah, well,
it is not at all like partial.
Yeah.
It is completely different.
Well, here in Albany, we had not only a partial eclipse, but the clouds rolled in just as we had a chance to see it. So it wasn't that exciting.
Yeah, the thing was, that Carbondale also had clouds, but I was out in Murfreesboro, which is about 10 miles west of there, and it was wonderful.
Cool.
Oh, man.
Cool.
Never forget the experience.
You got a question?
Anyway, the question was, what is the diameter of the shadow on the Earth, of the moon?
It depends on how close the moon is at the time of the eclipse. Sometimes the moon is closer, sometimes it's further away.
Oh, right.
But generally speaking, mm-hmm. it's about 150 miles in diameter.
And it also matters where you are in the path of totality, because if you think about the shadow of your hand, if you put it directly in front of you, between you and a light source, for example, mm-hmm. your hand is going to be approximately the same size as your hand, just magnified. But if you look at it, if you just twist it or move it a little bit to the side, you'll get that slanty view, and so you'll get that slanty shadow. So it even depends where in the path of totality you are. If you're in the center, near where you were in Carbondale, you would have gotten it just about, because you have a long totality time, that means that it was pretty much right on you.
Huh.
Right. It should be noted, however, that the oval shape of the moon, because it occurs because the Earth is round,
mm-hmm.
and the oval part of it really is in the direction of the motion of the moon. So it doesn't change much in terms of time, but it does change a little bit in terms of the size.
There you go, Pierre. Thanks for the call. There's a great video I saw. I think NASA tweeted it out.
With the satellite image?
And it shows the shadow going right across.
Right. You know, yeah. and I was lucky enough in 1979 to see the totality then and not really be able to appreciate it because I was a rebellious teen. But I think the neatest thing is really the sunset that you get all the way around, because you end up with a sunset effect, not just in the west or like a sunrise in the east, but it's all around that zone of totality. So as you look off into the horizon from under that dome of dark, you get sunrise and sunset and everything in between all the way around you.
Yeah, and I understand that NASA got 67 telescopes along the line of totality this time.
They did.
And they kept awe on it the entire time, so they have 90 minutes of totality that's going to come out one of these days.
That's great. And
what a movie.
The network TV, the news networks did a great job and went from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
And they also showed in Oregon, where I guess it was
first
seen
made
here on the mainland.
Right.
They showed what you talked about, all of a sudden, darkness. It's night, or at least very dark twilight,
yeah.
And the people just sort of freaked out.
Yeah, we can barely contain ourselves. We have such a short attention span, and to think that there's something very primal about humans really getting into this totality thing. You know, a new app drops or a Netflix series comes on, and people are like crazy, and then they're like, "Yeah, whatever."
Yeah.
But this kept everyone's attention, and I wonder if in 2025 or 2024, if it'll do it again.
Well, it's only 2.5 minutes long. People can keep their attention for that long.
But they have to drive there, make the hotel reservations, drive back, all that stuff.
I just got to thinking about what the ancients must have thought.
Oh, you can see why virgins were sacrificed.
Well, I'd like to know about that town in Illinois and what they're going to do when it comes across twice.
Yes, right.
Well,
they're saving their glasses for 7 years.
About $10,000 a room.
Let's go to Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody. I have to admit, I'm find it discouraging and I'm talking with people and trying to convince them about climate change, and it seems like it's difficult to persuade anybody. So my question to you is, what are the most effective or convincing reasons you would give, one or two, to support, or, and I don't want to pigeonhole you, so I'll say to support or question that humans are the primary cause of climate change?
Okay.
So I can bolster my arguments.
Well, I'm thinking of a T-shirt you can buy that it says, "Science doesn't care if you believe in climate change or not; it's going to happen
anyway."
So, what you're asking is what convincing piece of proof could you use as a support of your argument? But I'll let Ed do that one, because I'm thinking more of what you can do to actually take a little chunk out of your contribution to climate change. Let me put it that way.
Well, it's been sort of, put aside, but the trick with climate change is that the Earth goes through climate change all the time. I mean, just 10,000 years ago, the temperature of the Earth was 8 degrees colder than it is now, and there are predictions that in about 2030, it's going to start cooling off again simply because the sun is getting colder and are not working as much as it did before. So We're living in a period of time of 10,000 years where the temperature hasn't changed very much. And as a result, any change becomes very, very important. During the 1600s, we had what's called the Little Ice Age.
A Maunder Minimum.
Yeah, and that during that period of time, the 1600s. During that period of time, the temperature of the Earth changed by 1.5 degrees, but it wasn't caused by the Industrial Revolution. Shortly after that, we had the Little Ice Age, where the temperature changed by about 1 degree in the other direction. So these variations occur all the time. But in terms of looking at man's effect on it, you can look at what the solar effect is. And up to about 1980, the sun and the temperature change were pretty well staying in association with each other. And you can tell that by looking, for example, at sunspot activity, which is directly related to how strong the sun is. But from about 1980 on, the temperature of the Earth has been going up much faster than the sun has been doing any effect to it. So,
and we see the carbon dioxide levels increasing to more closely match the increase in temperature.
Now, the big trick with carbon dioxide is that these oceans pick it up and they suck it up beautifully. provided there's not too much carbon dioxide. So generally speaking, the ocean is a buffer to the whole system, but we seem to have surpassed that, and that's what I would argue if you're looking for anthropomorphic purpose or explanation for what the Earth, what we're doing, is that we have effectively exceeded the ability of the ocean to soak up carbon dioxide, which is why the temperature is going up.
All right, let's go to Dave in Albany. Dave, you're on. Hello, Dave.
Did you mean Steve?
Oh, it says Dave. I'm sorry. Okay, we'll call you Steve or whatever you want.
Well, you usually call me Steve when I see you, Ray.
How you doing, Steve?
Anyway, I'm doing all right. How about you?
Good.
My question is back about the eclipse, because before the eclipse, there was some discussion, indeed on your program, about being able to see the sun's magnetic lines during totality. Mm-hmm. I think it was magnetic lines, but there was a pattern of lines, and I have seen the picture of it in the past. But I watched the NASA television broadcast of it, and that was never visible, although they showed lots of totality scenes and so forth. And I wondered why I never saw that.
Because it was live. You know, the issue is really you have to use a significant amount of filters in order to show it prior to totality, and then at totality, you need to be able to take those filters off in order to see the corona effect, the kind of the lit part of the outside atmosphere of the sun. And so I've only started seeing those pictures show up yesterday and today because it took some time for people to process them and do their Photoshop magic, not in create something out of nothing, but rather make sure that they could use the filters to their best ability to show the material.
In other words, those lines need to be filtered?
So if I had set up a TV camera just to be good at the total eclipse, where you have minimal light, then there would have been nothing to show for all of the partial eclipse up to that. So what they have to do is prepare the TV cameras for the partial eclipse, where you have lots of light, so you have lots of filters, and you have your f-stop really, really, really tight, or aperture really, really, really tight, and your f-stop really short. And then as it gets to totality, you have to switch cameras or switch your feeds. And so you can't really do that.
You have to open it up, in other words.
Yeah, and you can't do that on the fly with TV, so you have to have them either be, you know, in parallel and you switch back and forth, or you have still cameras or cameras that are ready just for certain events.
CNN, we were watching in the newsroom, actually did switch, and you did see the corona many times.
Yeah,
so
the big trick is you're looking at a billion to one difference in brightness. So you're going from a very, very bright sun to the corona, which is very, very weak by comparison.
Well, I actually saw I think I saw the corona. What I didn't see was that pattern of lines that are like a magnetic field.
They're very wispy. It's the directionality in the corona, which it makes it kind of wispy looking. So you think of like a child when they draw a sun up in the sky, like on a piece of paper. They put the ball first, and then they put the lines that come out, and they kind of look like a sunflower. Well, it wasn't quite like that. It was much more kind of long and hairy at the top and kind of bent to the side. So I'm using my hands. I'm sure you can see it on the radio,
too. Sure.
But
kind of up and then bent to the side, so you could infer that the magnetic effect was there.
Right.
All right, Steve, who was called Dave, we appreciate you being on the program today, sir. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabitz is here and Ed Stander, and let's go over to Tim in Boston Spa. Tim.
Yes, I have another question about lightning.
All
I have
right.
a good view of the western sky from where I live. And sometimes when a storm's rolling in, you can see a flash of lightning off, you know, 10 miles away or something. And then you get a little crack, and then a rolling thunder, and then all of a sudden a big boom. And I'm thinking that there's the little crack is the lightning, and then there's a echo effect of some sort.
Well, the lightning actually ionizes the air that it goes through. It effectively makes a vacuum, and the sound of the thunder is the air filling up that vacuum and smashing into itself.
Right.
So the crack is the original lightning coming through, and then the boom is the air filling up the void that was produced by the lightning. So there's
and that can take a second or two.
Well, you have to, because you've superheated the gas. The gas has to dissipate, and then you have that rushing in effect.
Right.
So it's
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it kind of claps together.
Thank heavens.
It finally made sense, Tim. This is quite a moment on the program.
Took me 17 years on
Thanks
the show.
A lot. Now, is ball lightning a thing? Is it real?
Ball lightning is a thing.
Yeah.
It's rare, but it's a thing.
It's been proven.
Yeah. There's video of ball lightning.
And what is it? And how does it how does it work? And why does it stay coherent as a ball or whatever it is, a blob?
It's, you know, this is one of the tough ones, again, to explain on the radio.
We'll try. I've got plenty of time.
Oh, boy.
Go ahead.
It's been a while since we got the ball. No, you don't want to watch this. I'm going to defer to our astronomer.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Yes. I'm not even going to try.
No? You can't tell me then it's real, then?
Well, it is real. It's been seen, and it's been produced in the laboratory. But producing it is very difficult. How do you keep it cohesive, as you say, over a long distance? And that is a very difficult thing to explain.
So the brain cell that used to know died, but but my memory says it has something to do with the humidity in the space as well. Something about the humidity keeps it ball lightning.
All right, so maybe that'd be homework for the next time?
That's homework.
Okay. Excellent. As you're stuck in traffic, you could think about that.
No, one. I'm certainly not going to do it while I'm in traffic.
We'll try to bring some with us
Let's
as well.
Go to Santiago in Plattsburgh. You're on.
Hi. I was just hearing you guys talk a lot about lightning, and I've just had a question in the back of my mind for a while, which is how would we go about harnessing the power that's in lightning for us to use?
Huh. The old Ben Franklin ploy.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an awful lot of energy, and boy,
in a short period of time,
and you don't exactly know how much you're going to get when you get it. So you better be ready. The problem is storage. You know, even if we could make a lightning rod, like on the top of the new Tappan Zee Bridge, because you figure it's going to strike a few times, and say, okay, lightning's going to hit here. Let's have a way to store up that energy. You have to have a storage system that will be able to take it all at once and not superheat the chemicals that are in the batteries. So the way a battery works is you have chemistry, you have chemicals that can take an electron or give an electron up and are willing to do that in a matrix of some sort. But if I were to take a whole bunch of electrons, so think of them like raisinets. So I'm going to give you a few raisinets, Ray, and then you're going to keep them in your pocket. They'll get a little mushy. And then when I say, I want those raisinets back, you're going to give them to me.
Okay.
But now I'm going to strike you with a lightning of raisinets, and I'm going to dump all those raisinets on you.
By the way, I've had this dream before.
Yeah. And you're going to be under a pile of raisinets, and you're going to be like, whoa, I can't take all these raisinets at once. What are you doing to me?
Right.
So if you put in enough energy and enough electrons, you'll actually melt the battery. So that's the problem.
What about a
capacitor?
Huge capacitor.
Yeah.
You could use a huge capacitor, but it would have to be, first of all, absolutely enormous. And the second problem is that you'd burn all the wires up as the thing came through.
Right.
It's very difficult to produce something that will allow that. You're talking about something that's, you know, 10 to 100,000 volts and huge amount of amps. And it's very, very difficult to harness it.
So I watched something over the weekend where the Russians were trying to make lightning. They had this huge system. This is the Soviets, actually.
Yeah.
It's abandoned now. But they had this huge
For now.
Generator. Yep. And the idea was they would, if a ballistic missile from, obviously, evil America were coming toward them, they would shoot it with their lightning ray. And that would strike and fry the electronics of the ICBM, and it would fall out of the sky and I don't know what then would happen.
Didn't Tesla experiment with transmitting electricity?
Oh, yeah. He could do it. Yep.
Oh, every time I get out of my car, I practice lightning production.
What do you mean?
Well,
the static charge.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
The trick with most static charges is it's a very, very high voltage, but very, very low amperage. And you can deal with that, but you can't deal with high voltage and amperage together, at least with the systems that we've got.
Well, for those who are just tuning in, explain what amperage is.
Okay, amperage is you got a wire and you got a bunch of little electrons that are trying to get through it, and they're pushing each other. And the amount of push is the amperage. So, for example, they're all piling up and you're standing here on the other side, right? And you come near it, there's so much pressure of those guys there that they start to jump out onto your finger, and that's what causes the static electricity.
That's a great explanation.
So that's amperage.
And how many you have
is the voltage.
Is the voltage.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. We'll take a quick break here, and then we'll be back with the home stretch. No theremin, but your calls and more of them coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Round Lake Auditorium, Round Lake, New York, announcing Thomas Dresler's Organ Concert, August 27th at 2:30 p.m., performing musicality with a historic technique, roundlakeauditorium.org. Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, careersintransitionllc.com. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, including Zenka from Paris and Coco Song from Italy, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY eyewearalbany.com. And George Heigl Antiques, Boston Spa, New York, offering estate sales services, including management, appraisals, and evaluations for individuals, families, and businesses, 518-396-7974.
Vox Pop, the Science Forum on WAMC. Ray Graff here, joined today by Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander. And the number for you to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. So things ramping up at SUNY Cobleskill?
Well, classes start Monday, except Ed's special, of course.
Well, we knew that.
Yes, I start on Saturday.
Really? And what are you doing on Saturday?
I'm taking a bunch of neophyte first-year geology students who've never had a geology course, and I'm throwing them in the field and making them figure out what's going on for themselves.
Are you a tough professor with the newbies? Like Houseman in the paper chase?
I keep them as far away as I can from the cliffs. That's all I do.
Well done.
There is a lot of physical exertion in field geology.
I've had students come back afterwards and say, can we get physical fitness credit for this thing.
Yeah, that's right. You should get a Fitbit with your graduation.
All right, let's go over to Harold in Rhinebeck. Harold, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I hope it's a simple question. I just went out, I believe it was last Sunday night, the 13th, because I had read about a meteor shower.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in Rhinebeck, near Rhinebeck, and I went to what I thought was a dark area. Thought I was looking in the right direction. I should be able to know if it's overcast or not, but it didn't really seem overcast.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 8, 9 o'clock at night. To make a long story short, I didn't see any meteors and
right. Wasn't
sure if I had done something wrong or maybe the 13th was too late. I get confused when I hear about meteor showers as to the time and direction to look and...
Okay, I can give you all.
That's a question.
I
can
give
you all the answers.
What was that one?
It was the Perseids.
Perseids.
And here's the trick. It's called the Perseids because that's the direction you have to look to be able to see them, which is the direction of Perseus, which is a constellation. The problem is that Perseus came up out of the horizon around 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, and at that point there was a very, very bright moon. So it made it very, very difficult. They were talking about it being a very, very good meteor shower, but with the moon there, you couldn't see the meteors anyway. I went out about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was sorely depressed. I missed it all. But that's basically it. The Leonids come from Leo. The Perseids come from Perseus. The Aquarids come from
Aquarius.
So it all depends on that. And you look at a map, and you can tell you exactly where it's from. If I can say one last thing, if you go on to spaceweather.com during the time of a meteor shower, it will show you where they are and what time they'll be coming up.
Which website was that? I'm sorry.
Spaceweather.com.
Right, spaceweather.com. Okay. It'll also tell you if there's a if there's an aurora coming. It'll tell you all sorts of things. It's a wonderful site.
Now, how accurately will they be able to predict an aurora coming? Often you'll hear, okay, this is going to be a good night for auroras, and there's a lot of activity on the sun, and, and then you don't see anything.
Well, they actually, on that site, they actually show a picture of the Earth and show where the auroral ring is. Mm.
At that moment.
And the trick is that, generally speaking, the auroral ring is much too high for us.
Yeah.
So it's only in that rare occasion when we get really hit by a solar flare that it comes down far enough for us to see.
So I was driving during the meteor shower to Georgia. I spent a lot of time in the car and a lot of time at night. And even it was late at night, 1 o'clock in the morning or so, and even though it was pouring rain, all of a sudden the sky lit up and I saw a swish.
Oh, cool. Yep.
And I saw a meteor through a rain cloud. That was the best.
And those are called fireballs. They're so strong.
Bolide?
A bolide. Yeah. But a bolide is just the meteor itself, for the meteorite.
Ah.
But they're called fireballs because they lighten up the sky.
All right, let's go over to Merle in Argyle. Merle.
Hi, how you guys doing?
We're doing all right.
All right. This has to do about the eclipse. Basically, one of the things about the eclipse is studying the corona during the eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't you have flown a plane in front of the eclipse across the whole United States and had hours of corona study?
Well,
or has that been tried?
They don't really have to do that because they have satellites now that block the sun. So in space, for example, there's SOHO. They can actually block the light of the sun and see the corona all the time. So they have lots of coronal images. They don't really need it from the Earth.
Well, getting back to the nuts and bolts of Merle's question, is that feasible to do?
Except that the moon's shadow is traveling 1,700 miles an hour across the Earth's surface. So you need a special plane.
We could do
plane.
That, though.
You need a special plane to go that fast. We got rid of the Concorde.
Oh, it would have to be 1,700 miles an hour?
Yeah.
Just about.
Oh, okay.
It would have it would have to take 90 minutes to go across the United States.
You get an SR-71, you're good to go.
Yeah.
Well, Merle, thank you very much. Our number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander. And let's go over to Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim.
You are doing an absolutely fantastic show today.
Oh, gosh.
I called up with a little glib thing about the eclipse, but I have seen ball lightning.
Mm.
I have observed the meteorite showers. I got a degree in earth science education, and I was a Navy meteorologist on an aircraft carrier in 1972, and your program is absolutely spectacular. But I'll give you my little thing on the eclipse.
Okay.
I took my lady friend up to the Petersburg Pass with my welder's helmet, and we watched the eclipse from the time it started until the time it ended. And we met some really neat people up there and had a good old eclipse party.
That's cool.
So there you go.
Hey, now tell us, Donna, before you go, tell us about your ball lightning sighting.
It was in the Mediterranean in 1972. I was on the aircraft carrier, and it was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
How big was the ball? Could you tell from where you were?
I'm going to say almost sun diameter.
Wow.
Was it up in the rigging of the ship? Because you always hear old sailors' reports in logs of
Elmo's fire.
St. Elmo's fire, right.
No, it was off on the horizon.
Interesting.
Cool. Do you know what time of year it was?
I was on the ship, and I observed it on the horizon, and I reported it because, you know, I was a Navy meteorologist, and we were required to report things like that to the rest of the fleet and put it out over the teletype to the rest of the world, and it went into my report.
How do you know it was ball lightning?
It was.
It's a big ball of lightning.
You can't escape ball lightning. When you see it, you know what the hell it is.
Okay. All right.
Hopefully, as it goes away from you.
Yeah, I wonder how long can... Thanks, Jim. We appreciate the call. How long could ball lightning stay intact?
So I watched a video when YouTube was first on, and we used to have Mike from University at Albany, who was on the science forum with us. He was a meteorologist. And so he would always answer these questions
Mike
so well. Mike Landon, there you go. And so YouTube happens, and, you know, I'm not looking at celebrities or videos. I'm like, I want to see this ball lightning.
Yeah, yeah.
So I look at it, and it's somebody's grainy, you know, VHS camera trained in their living room, and there's a ball lightning right outside the living room window.
Yep.
And it was a couple minutes.
What would prevent it from going right through the window?
Sure. Nothing to stop it.
Well, it's terrifying.
Right.
All right. Well, let's go over to Eli in Utica. Eli, you're on.
Hi, folks. So I've got a response for the gentleman who was wondering how to react to his friends to convince them of the reality of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not a scientist. I actually failed my chemistry regents, I'm sorry to say. But
classes start Monday.
But so I don't talk science. What I do, and it really makes people stop and think, I explain to them that we have 34 major scientific institutions in the United States. The American Society for the Advancement of Science, American mm-hmm. Chemical Society, American Geophysical Union, the Biological Institute, a whole listing, all 34. If you go to their web pages, their websites, they will tell you that global warming is a reality. It's primarily man-made. It's going to be extremely costly in the future to the world. And that stops and makes them think. I mean, they're used to seeing maybe debates from scientist Joe and scientist Jim on television, you know, one pro, one con. But that makes them realize that there is a uniformity of opinion of science, and they trust science, even though maybe they're not any better at it than I am. They believe in science, and that really, I think, is a valuable tool to make people stop short and realize that this is a factual situation.
Sounds good.
Great. Eli, thanks a lot for the call. And let's go now over to line four. And Frank and Troy. Frank, you're on.
Hi. I had a question about the formation of petroleum.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I know it comes from decaying plant matter and the dinosaurs that died, but how does it happen to get like thousands and thousands of miles under the Earth's surface?
Well, petroleum usually forms in an environment where trees and other living matter gets trapped and buried very quickly so it doesn't rot. That's the first step. And that usually occurs in places like deltas, where you've got lots and lots of plant material, and you've got sand coming in, and the sand washes onto it, and it piles up. Okay? Over time...
All right. So over millions of years, you get thousands of feet of, or thousands of miles of sediment.
Well, you get lots of sediment on top of it, but the trick with petroleum is you also need a heat source, because you have to take that stuff and not just compress it to make coal, but you've actually got to effectively heat it up enough so you distillate the petroleum out of it. And that occurs mostly because those areas where the deltas first formed, places where oceans started to open up, are places where you get hot spots underneath the Earth. Effectively, they're places where the mantle is burning into the crust. So you've got two things going on. You've got stuff being deposited and put under a lot of pressure, and you have heat underneath that's distillating it and forming a liquid out of it. And then that stuff, because it's much lighter than the rocks around it, rises up and gets caught. And that's what mm-hmm. becomes a dome, and that's where the it becomes trapped.
Okay, thank you.
Frank, you're thank you very much easy. For the call. 800.
So it doesn't always have to be deep. It can be pretty close to the surface. You can still have petroleum pretty close to the surface, but I think after about 100 years of doing this, we've gotten most of that stuff, and now we're kind of going for the deep stuff.
Yeah, we get tar pits and things like that, which is effectively seeps where the petroleum gets to the surface.
Our number is 800-348-2551, and David in North Adams is on. David.
I had an experience close up with ball lightning when I was a boy
in
New Hampshire. Yeah, around 1955.
Do you know what time of year it was?
And I, yeah, a year, 55.
No, what time of year? I'm sorry, season.
Yes, it was midsummer.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And it's about 8 o'clock at night, and my family and I were sitting around the fire in a summer cabin in a thunderstorm, and suddenly a huge ball of lightning came right through the west window of the house.
Wow.
It was about a foot in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to float about 6 feet above the floor through the room. And it moved very slowly. And when it got to the middle of the room, it touched a chandelier that had all the electric light bulbs in it, and every one of them blew out.
Wow.
And then it continued on all the way across the room, and it exited through an east window.
Now, what if it had touched David? What if it had bumped into David?
His bulbs would have blown.
I've often wondered.
That's funny.
Because it short-circuited those light bulbs.
Really interesting.
I just think of the video series Stranger Things. You know, it's just...
But it was so spectacular. I remembered like it just happened.
I'll bet.
Yeah. Well, David, thank you for that one. We appreciate it. Over to Pat and Wilton. Pat, you're on.
Yeah. Hi. I almost got hit by ball lightning once. It was the craziest thing. Where it was a bad thunderstorm, and I had a horse with a new foal out in the paddock, and I ran out to get the horse out of the paddock, and lightning hit a tree that was about 50 feet away from me to my left. I was pulling on the horse, trying to get her out of the paddock, and she was, like, rearing back because she was scared. And the lightning went down the tree, blew out the side, and I saw the ball coming at me, mm-hmm. like, right at me.
Right.
And it got about 10 feet away from me, and it went, it made an audible pop and disappeared.
I'm amazed you could see or hear the pop, considering
that. Yeah, that's how close you were. Woo.
So is that a clue then that it was lightning from a cloud lightning that hit a tree and then created the ball lightning?
And then the humidity has a component to this that we're going to figure out on my homework. But the humidity helps to conduct this ball. So you need an ability to conduct this electricity through air, and air is not particularly conductive.
Right.
So that's why I think it has to be enormously humid. Right.
Which it normally is when it's raining.
Was pouring. And I think the reason it blew out the side of the tree was that the tree was only wet down to about, 8 or 10 feet above the ground.
Oh, right. And then it wasn't wet anymore. So
blew out the side.
Well, what normally happens there is that when the lightning hits the tree, pieces of that lightning go through all the branches of the tree. And so it's not concentrated in one place. And what you'll see is that where the branches of the tree stop, that's where it suddenly takes a beeline down to the bottom. And when it gets into mm-hmm. that section, what it does is it effectively vaporizes the water in the tree.
Right, the sap.
And that's what blasts the thing out.
Right. Huh. So you're superheating the sap the same way you're superheating the air when a lightning strike hits. And that blows out the side of the tree.
So you're lucky to be alive, Pat. Well done.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, it was about 16 inches across, and it scared the heck out of me, but...
What color was it?
The experience.
What color was it?
It was white. Well, it seemed to be white. I don't know. It was the flash. My eyes were kind of half blinded by the hit on the tree.
Wow. I'd never go outside again. Well, Pat, thanks a lot for the call. And, we only have 1 minute here. We'll go over to line 10. Bob, you only have about 30 seconds.
Hi, this is Bob. Can you hear me?
Yep, you got about 30 seconds, Bob.
Why do clouds, all the molecules in the clouds stick together and you have form a cloud, but you have 20 clouds and they don't come together a bit? What keeps clouds away from each other?
All right, 30 seconds, panel.
Well, what sticks them together are hydrogen bonds. Water likes to be near other water, and it's a short interaction over very, very, very short distances on the molecular level. And then you just think of like a daisy chain, like a barrel full of monkeys. They're all kind of interacted together. But if I put a barrel full of monkeys next to another barrel full of monkeys, the monkeys don't migrate from one barrel to another. They stay kind of tangled together.
And also, at that level where the clouds form, you have what's called the dew line, a dew point. And effectively, sometimes it goes higher and sometimes it goes lower, so you'll get it in one place and not another.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. 800-348-2551. I gave you the number, but the show's over. But remember it for tomorrow when it's a Food Friday. Support comes from Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival, presenting Rhinebeck playwright Richard Nelson's The General from America about Benedict Arnold's plot to betray West Point through September 3rd. hvshakespeare.org. The Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, dedicated to strengthening our bonds with nature. Wildcenter.org for details. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. And the Henyon Bakery, Amherst since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Thanks again to Ed and Barbara for being here. Thanks to you for the great calls. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Deb Malik took your calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, the Food Friday program, we're going to get a taste of Troy. You ever wonder what Troy tastes like? Well, we'll find out tomorrow. So right now, though, stand by for news.